Part 11 of The Roots of Buddhist Psychology, a teaching on sympathetic joy with Jack Kornfield.
The third of these states or qualities that can be discovered or cultivated is a quality called in Sanskrit or Pali mudita. And mudita means joy, or sometimes it's translated as spiritual joy or sympathetic joy, joy in the happiness of others. And often we don't get to choose the circumstances of our life, but we do get to choose the response and to celebrate life in all of its circumstances. So this particular quality in Buddhist psychology speaks to the innate capacity to find joy, happiness, delight, rapture, pleasure, beauty in the amazing display of being alive. Sometimes it's talked about as sympathetic joy, that is the happiness that we get in the joy of things around us and in the pleasure of seeing the welfare of other beings. Just as we talked about compassion as the movement of the heart in relationship to the struggle or the sorrow of another being, that sympathetic vibration. This is the movement of the heart in the joy and the happiness that we take in the success of another, in the pleasure of another. In this quality of sympathetic joy is most profoundly an understanding of interdependence, that the happiness of others brings happiness to us, that the success of others brings happiness to us. Spiritual joy is the happiness in seeing the mystery or the wonder of life. And as spiritual life grows and one sense of body and mind and heart opens, which is the purpose of practice, the joys get greater. Now, the near enemy, it said, to this quality is the comparing mind. How much do I have versus them? Who gets what share? That's sort of a variety of competition, thinking that there isn't enough joy to go around. And if somebody else is too happy, then I won't have my share. Like there isn't enough love to go around. Somebody else will own it all. But it doesn't work that way when you begin to look into the psychology of the heart. You start to see that it is the opposite, that our joy and another's joy can play together, dance together, that there's a music of the heart which enhances or awakens from one being to another. And that happiness isn't something that's someplace else, but here rather, kind of one of the exemplars of the joy of spiritual life is the poet Rumi. An enormous generosity and humor in his work called Ecstatic Groundedness, Wild Moments, Drunken Lyrics, Starry Clarity, Great Pleasure, all these things. And Rumi, after his awakening, he met this wandering dervish and looked him in the eyes and heard a few of his teachings, and then just dropped his whole life and started to wander after that. And disciples followed Rumi around what is now Turkey, that part of the world. And he would just look around at the sky or take his bath or go in the river and get water or whatever it was, and verses would pour out of him, tens of thousands of verses, 10,000 pages of Rumi's poetry that just poured through him. It's like the writer of operas, Puccini, who said, I've done nothing. I simply write down what I hear from God. Or Mozart, you know, who didn't really compose. He just heard it come and he wrote it down. I remember sitting around the table one day at a gathering, some kind of conference or other, people who teach in spiritual and psychological circles, and there were 8 of us or 9 of us all sitting there who had at some point or other written 1 or several books and started some different teaching schools or programs or whatever. And I was in the middle of writing at that time, and I said I had a problem. I was sitting in this beautiful library at the seminary in San Anselmo, and all of a sudden one of those leaf blowers came along. It was the fall time blowing these leaves, and I couldn't write. And it wasn't just that I was annoyed, although that happened too, but even after the annoyance passed, I couldn't write. And I realized, now why can't I write? All this going on. I was just, because I couldn't hear the words. And actually I was sitting there waiting and listening, and the words would come and then I would write them down. And so I said, does that happen to you? I know, where do you get the books that you write to these people? And one person said, I actually feel them coming up from the earth through my body. And the other said, no, no, that's not true for me. He said, I kind of visualize this sense of space, and then it's like these sentences pour down. Someone else said, no, I hear them. But it was clear that nobody was writing their own material. Right? So joy arises when we become still enough to realize what is always pouring through us in our breath, in our sight, in our ears, in our heart. It comes whenever we are connected with our deepest love, to parent a child or plant a garden, whether it's painting or in commerce or healing or whatever it is, something that we care about. And then we become a vessel for that energy of life to move through us. And when we awaken, we see it everywhere. The grains of sand look like jewels. That's the Buddhist image. The grains of sand and the Ganges are like sparkling jewels. Or in an egg. Just go to the supermarket and buy an egg and look at it. Look at it. Isn't this amazing? A whole being inside this shell. Or in the waves of the ocean that sing their song over and over and over and over and over the same song. Or as Whitman says, a mouse is miracle enough to stagger sextillions of infidels, the unbelievers. Just show one thing that's alive. Where did it come from? Life is this simple, says Thomas Merton. We are living in a world that is absolutely transparent, and the divine is shining through it all the time. This is not a fable or a nice story. It is true. It's what we are made of. It's very ordinary as well. The joy and the kindness and the interconnectedness. When your eyes are open, you see it all the time. Even in little ways, not just the images of nature, beautiful trees at sunset, but the fact that we're all willing to drive on the right-hand side of the road and mostly stop at stop signs and red lights. When I drove a taxi in Boston, it wasn't that way. They considered red lights to be a suggestion for taxi drivers. The fact that we're willing to wait in line in the supermarket and say thank you. There's this whole dance of respect that we enter into every day when we get up, when we walk around, when we drive, when we enter schools and stores and places of our work and places where we get our food. And we participate. It's as if we bow to each other all the time. We get up and just go in the store and take stuff. You know, it's been done. It's not far away. And what this joy suggests is the possibility of seeing that, resting in that, knowing that, seeing it in a deeper way. The saints are what they are, this is Thomas Merton again, not because of their sanctity, but because the gift of sainthood makes it possible for them to admire everybody else. Isn't that lovely? It's not that they're saintly, but they see the beauty in others. It gives them the clarity of compassion that can find good in every being. To see the eagle in the egg, the butterfly in the caterpillar, and beauty in the sinner. Thomas Merton again. Their sanctity is not it, but their ability to see beauty in another. What's made you happy recently? Think about it for a minute. Probably not very complicated, whatever it was. There was a psychology class given some years ago, part of which was after the section on behaviorism and the section on industrial psychology, whatever, was a part on sensory perception and sensory awareness. And the exam at the end of that portion came, the students came in the classroom, and the instructor put out a huge bowl of oranges, one for every person in this big class, and said, come down and take an orange. And all the students came and took an orange. Bring it back to your seat, and now your exam is to write down and describe your experience of this orange. What it smells like, what it feels like when you rub it on your skin, touch it, what it sounds like when you squish it a little bit. He didn't tell them what to write, but this is what you could do. The sounds the orange would make as you rolled it on the floor, as you squished it, you know, what it feels like under your fingernails, the aura of orange around it, how far away you might smell it, its particular shape, whether it was really round, is an orange really round, or what's its shape? That was the first part of the exam, to describe it. Then he collected the oranges, put them all out on this big table, and the second part of the exam was to go and find your orange among all of them. See how long it took you to find your orange. And you know what? Everybody found their orange really easily and quickly because they had really looked at it and listened and felt it and made friends. It's like the Russian astronauts coming back to the Earth, you know, who weren't sure they were going to get back and getting down and kissing the ground just to be back here. Feel the breeze on their skin. Breathe the air. So with awakening of the preciousness of life, the beauty of it, there comes joy and a kind of responsibility. This is from André Gide. He says, know that joy is rarer, more difficult, and more beautiful than sadness. Once you make this all-important discovery, you must embrace joy as a moral obligation. Only a Frenchman could say it like that. No. Ha-ha, embrace the joy. To sense this is to take responsibility for your heart and for what seeds you plant in the garden, what you bring alive on this earth. Because there's every possibility within you. What do you plant in the garden of this eternal present that will bloom here? One day Zorba walked along the road and saw an old man in his 90s planting an almond tree. It takes an almond tree 20, 30 years to bear fruit and almonds. It's a long process. And he said, why are you doing that? To the old man. And the old man said, I carry on as if I should never die. And Zorba said, and I live as if I might die any moment. Which of these is right? Raise your hands. No, it's okay. They're the same in a way, huh? That same respect and joy. In the Buddhist teachings, it said that the capacity for joy grows out of the pure heart. The purity or the beauty of one's heart. So after all his struggling and wrestling as a yogi and an ascetic in the myth or the story of the Buddha in India, finally, almost dead from exhaustion and self-mortification and fasting, the Buddha lay there And then there came that vision of the day when he was a boy sitting under the rose apple tree in his father's garden, the spring morning under this beautiful tree. And everything was whole and complete and absolutely still, unified. And Buddha realized, I've gone the wrong way. I've been trying to beat myself, my desires and fears into submission as a warrior. And it was there all along. The capacity for joy comes naturally out of the heart. Pure heart, beautiful heart. Like a lovely flower, bright but scentless, are the fine but empty words of one who does not live what they say and mean what they say. But like a lovely flower, filled with fragrance and beautiful scents, are the fine and truthful words of a being who lives what they say and mean. So when people would ask the Buddha, what is the purpose, or how do you know someone who's fulfilled spiritual life? And he would say they have a beautiful heart, that a true wise man or a wise woman, a true sage, a Brahman, is not by birth, by caste, by race or color or creed. That is all nonsense. You can't tell from the outside. That's our insanity. But nobility, a true noble person, comes from within, from the heart, when the heart is pure. And it shines in the world. When I was 6 years old, my mother took me to school on opening day, writes this woman. This is one of these random Acts stories. Sometime during that first day, a small boy started to cry. This is a lot like my daughter, who's very much in this temperament. I immediately went over to him and put my arms around him. I guess he was afraid the first day of school. The teacher ordered me to return to my assigned seat. You remember school, huh? I couldn't believe this teacher's indifference to this boy, because whenever I cried at home, some member of my family would be right there with their arms around me. My teacher kept telling me to leave the boy alone, that he should cry it out himself, and I kept refusing to obey her until the boy stopped crying. Then, and only then, I left. I went home that day with a note to my mother stating that I was rude, disobedient, and a troublemaker. Six. So I told my mother what had happened, and she came back to school with me the next day. She told my teacher that I'd been taught to be considerate and caring toward others, and that I was not likely to change. She strongly advised my teacher to get used to my sympathetic nature. That incident happened 72 years ago, and I've enjoyed hugging a lot of people since then. When we are able to appreciate this moment for what it is, to let go of our plans and how it's supposed to be, and our fears, and come into the stillness of this moment, there's always a beauty. You know those Zen temples that have those rock gardens? I mean, it's just a few big rocks and a lot of gravel, right? And yet they're amazingly beautiful. The monk's robes that you wear when you live in the monastery have all these patches on them. And they're actually done, they're patched together from old cloth, but they're done in a particular fashion. And the story goes that one day, early on in their wanderings, the Buddha and his cousin Ananda were sitting on a hillside in the forests of India and looked down over the plains of the Ganges in the springtime, the bright green of the rice shoots coming up. Said some kind of poem about how beautiful the rice was. And then said, do you think we could make our robes look like that, those beautiful squares? And so from then on, the robes of the monks and the nuns were cut in the kind of square shapes of the rice paddies for their beauty. But it's a deep spiritual question. How to bring beauty and joy alive in this human realm, on this earth, in this world. How to be happy. One friend who's a meditation teacher will tell students at the end of interviews, to finish the interview, and she'll say, be happy. You know, and you think, well, that's kind of like have a nice day in California, right? It's just a... But it's actually not that. It's an instruction. This is how to practice. Let yourself find the happiness that's there within you in a deep way. It's what we sit for. We actually sit to be happy. We sit to heal and to grieve and to discover and learn and get free. All those things, find a freedom within ourselves. But underneath, in some way, we seek to find what is true happiness. And there is a longing in every human being for harmony, for beauty, for joy. Remember those moments when you really feel that? Another Frenchman, Camus, wrote, he said, a person's life is a slow trek to rediscover through the detours of art those two or three moments in whose presence their heart first opened. Spiritual life, art, whatever, you have those moments when your heart first opens, like the Buddha under the rose apple tree, and then you spend a long time trying to remember how to get back to who you were, who you are in those moments. You can think about it, reflect. What is the joy, the peace, the beauty, that understanding heart that you seek to live in, that you seek to reawaken, to remember? It's there in everybody. Last year, at one of the multicultural men's retreats that I've been a part of, the circuit of Michael Mead, Malidoma Sommei, and James Hillman and others, one of these retreats, which are really places of ritual and initiation in some ways, there are also places for people to come together in a ritual way to listen to one another, to our sorrows and struggles and humanity, respectfully. And at this retreat, a whole variety of people, European American, African American, Latino, Native American, dancing, storytelling, drumming. And there was a lot of pain expressed. Veterans talking, telling their stories of being in Vietnam and what it was like. People looking at the pain of their backgrounds, of racism, of either having been the slave or the son of slaves or grandson, great-grandson, or the son or great-grandson of slaveholders. It was hard to tell. Sometimes the pain from each side was so compelling. And everybody was telling their stories and being there, except for a couple guys who were sitting in the back row. And they didn't say anything for almost the whole week. One man, particularly in the back row, really big guy, who was just sitting back there, slouched down, the red hat pulled down so he could just barely see, kind of checking out the scene. And all these people are sharing their stories and really opening themselves up in a rare way. But there's this tension in the room because there are these guys in the back sitting like that who haven't said anything, you know? You know when that, when there's somebody in the room that doesn't feel like they're connected. Michael Mead was drumming and telling an old myth or story from the time of King Arthur, about a young man who longed to become a true prince. And this young man went through a variety of trials, and in the midst of them, oh, he was actually a prince, but in the midst of difficulties in the kingdom where he was growing up as a prince, he heard a troubadour come and tell a story about the most beautiful castle in the world. and the most gracious princess and the most benevolent and just kingdom. And this description, and it was just luminous. And he couldn't get it out of his mind, and he went to his father, the king, because he was a prince, and he said, I want to go there. And this, I've heard of this, and I must find this for myself. And his father, having heard the story, also knew that there was great danger. Had to go through a dark forest and, you know, defeat certain beings in battle, dragons and whatever. And he didn't want his son to be lost. Others had gone and never come back. As the king, he said, I forbid you to go. And the prince said, I would die without this that I've heard of. The kingdom of justice, the most gracious princess, the most beautiful castle. I've heard of this, I can picture it, I can feel it in myself. I cannot live without this. And so he sat down in the throne room of the king and said, I shall not get up until you let me go. I will not eat and I will not drink. Kind of a hunger strike. You know how kids can do that, right? I won't. And he sat and he sat and he didn't. He didn't get up. And he didn't eat and he didn't drink and he got paler and weaker. And finally, parents being what they are, this father gave in and said, all right, you can go. And then the story went on with the adventure of what took him to that kingdom. And the stories, the essence of it was about how men, and women for that matter, love beauty. Long for beauty. We all search for beauty our whole lives, for what is true and beautiful in ourselves. Aunt Michael told the story, and at the end he asked if anyone understood what he was talking about. This is the end of the week. Finally, this guy, been sitting back there, kind of pulled his red hat up, stood up, and pulled out of his pocket this kind of long, crumpled piece of paper and uncurled it and read several pages of a long poem of pain and grief and of the dignity and beauty of the African people and the African American people that he was a part of. And then he said he didn't know if he belonged in that group until he heard that story that night. He was listening to everybody talk to each other and tell their stories. But as soon as he heard that story, he said he knew that that's what he'd been looking for his whole life. There's a beauty even in our sorrows, in depression, or jealousy, or pain. There's a kind of patience and understanding that comes when we know how to be with those too, that deepen us, make us compassionate and alive in our hearts. But what's asked for us is not to dwell in those places forever. Joy comes when we discover, it's a reminder, that we can release our sorrows. It's the third noble truth of the Buddha teaching. There's not just sorrow in the world, but there's freedom, there's awakening, there's happiness. We are asked, each of us in our spiritual practice, to find the way to release our sorrows, to bow to our sorrows, to respect the story, and find what's beautiful. Rumi, all this thirst equipment must surely be tired of me, the water jar, the water carrier, so small. I have a thirsty fish in me that can never find enough of what it's thirsty for. Show me the way to the ocean. Break these half measures, these small containers, all this fantasy and grief. A great silence overcomes me. Just now, I wonder why I ever thought to say a word. In spiritual life, there is a kind of healing that takes place. But we can also use it to become judgmental of ourselves, to increase our struggle. You're not spiritual enough. You're not happy enough. You're not free enough. You're too self-centered. You know, you judge too often. And even now you're judging, right? And so forth. So we become critical of ourselves and critical of others. The attention of mindfulness, the presence of the heart, is not a judgment or an evaluation or a comparison one to another. It's a kind of respect that we give to life, the miracle that's just alive that we are. One rabbi encountered a man who was eating on the fast day when you were supposed to fast. "Surely you've forgotten that this is a fast day," the rabbi said. "No," answered the man, "I know today is the day of the fast." "Well then, you're sick, you're not well, your doctors instructed you not to fast," said the holy rabbi. "No, I'm perfectly healthy," said the man. Then the rabbi lifted his eyes toward heaven. "Look how precious your children are, O Lord. I've provided this man with ample excuses to explain away his behavior, but he refuses to deviate from the truth even when it incriminates him. How beautiful he is." Isn't that amazing? Even our jealousy, our willfulness, our pain or depression, all of those can be met from a place of understanding and beauty and respect. Well, what supports this sense of joy? Stillness, walking in nature, caring for our bodies and community around us. Company of the wise. Sympathetic joy, it's called, because you catch it from other people. You catch it from children, from other happy people. Here again, a story for you. Some years ago, on a Sunday morning in Seattle, a young priest stopped to talk to a person in the parish and a 5-year-old little girl named Carmen. The little girl had a new jump rope, and the priest began to show her how to jump rope with this kind of robes flying. And she got really excited about it, and she began to jump, did it once, stepped on the rope, a couple more times stepped on the rope. Finally, after a while, she started to get it, and the mother and the priest clapped loudly as she got better at it. And eventually she was able to jump quite well on her own, wandered off with the jump rope to go play by herself. And the mother and the priest sat there talking for a while. And then the girl, little girl Carmen, came up looking sad, eyes kind of teary, dragging her jump rope. She says, "Mommy, I can jump, but I need a lot of clapping to do it." You know what I mean? So the Buddha talks about celebration, rejoicing in the holy life, in the good life. Discover freedom, discover happiness, discover a sovereignty or a dignity that is your birthright, whoever you are. O nobly born, remember this, and then go forth in every direction for the happiness, the harmony, the welfare of the many. Offer your heart, the seeds of your own understanding, like a lamp overturned and relit again, illuminating the darkness. Like a cloud that darkens the sun being dispelled. Go and take pleasure in things. The pleasure not of accumulating or grasping, but the pleasure in being alive. Like music, the changes of the weather, the rain, the taking of tea, a glass of wine, the singing of each thing. It's this that makes spiritual joy. You know, as you meditate, and as one learns in a deeper way to meditate, there comes, believe it or not, periods of rapture, bliss, happiness, even ecstasy. It can come, really, really. I know that's not everyone's experience, and it doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. It just comes like grace at times, or when you're very still and things drop away that you worry and struggle with, things become whole inside. And first your body starts to uncurl and all the little cells kind of let go and become happy and start to dance inside. And you can feel it. Your breath becomes easier and bigger and the energy moves within you. And there's warm rapture, and then there's cool rapture, and there's cold rapture, and there's tingles and trills and waves and bliss. And you can sit, and when you're not wanting anything and you're really present, the breath changes and the body opens, and there's this sense of an innate well-being and joy that happens. And if you don't think it's true, look at toddlers. Look at what you were before you put on some of the armor that you may have needed, but that's nice to learn to take off once in a while, huh? I love toddlers, like between 1 and 2 years, the ones that walk around like they're drunk. My favorite age. I remember when Caroline was that age, she would wander around and I'd scoop her up and I'd introduce her to things. I'd bring her over, put her little hand on a tree and say, "This is an oak tree." And look her up, look at this huge oak tree, and you know, "This is a walnut tree which we had in our, and here's a walnut." She'd smell it and look at it and stick it in her mouth. "Here's sand," you know, and she'd play with the sand and put it in her mouth, right? And "here's a leaf," and she'd look at it and I'd tear it in half, and she'd look at it and crumple it up and put it down and pick it up, and it's so wonderful. It was like there was pleasure in every single thing. "Dear God, I keep waiting for spring, but it never comes yet. Please don't forget, Mark." Children's letters to God. "Dear God, you don't have to worry about me. I always look both ways, Dale." "Dear God, if you watch in church on Sunday, I will show you my new red shoes, Lucy." What this state of sympathetic joy is, in the end, it's the kindness and pleasure of a loving parent. Just like when we do the loving kindness meditation, you think of the image from the Buddhas of a mother or father holding their only beloved child. This is the happiness of a parent, the kindness and joy in the success of their child. When the child first learns to walk and turns around and smiles to you, "I did it. I actually learned to take some steps and I wasn't even holding on." You know, or when the child first learns how to swing. Remember when you first learned how to swing on a swing and you first started to pump yourself and you could get yourself going, and there's this tremendous sense of exhilaration and pleasure in it? I remember when my daughter first blew the first bubble from bubble gum. I mean, it was just ecstasy. "Look at what I've done." And bubbles and bubbles and bubbles and drawing. And the pleasure that you take in the success and the blessings and the well-being of other beings. That's the practice of sympathetic joy. And the thing is that they're all your children. Sometime a long, long time ago, they were your mother or your father, because you've been doing it a long time. And your uncle and your aunt and your grandfather and your grandmother. And they were each your daughter or your son, and maybe again. So it's the pleasure of seeing every living being as if they were your child, with that success and friendliness and happiness. May you be successful. May you be happy. May you be filled with joy and blessings. May you succeed wildly, fully, completely.
This concludes part 11 of The Roots of Buddhist Psychology. Please turn the tape over for part 12.